Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. Play them later. 312-981-7200. And that's also the number to call if you have any space-related questions or comments to text or call us at 312-981-7200. Our guest right now is Rod Pyle. He's an award-winning filmmaker, writer, and journalist on the topic of space. His latest book is called Interplanetary Robots. It's going to be released in a couple of weeks. It's available for pre-order now, and you can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com for more information. Lots of stuff to talk with Rod about, so let's get him on the air right now. Hey, Rod, how are you?
Good. Happy New Year, Nick.
Happy New Year to you, too, my friend. So how did your New Year's go? Did you celebrate and everything?
Actually, I was sick for 3 weeks, so I kind of celebrated quietly. But I got a lot of work done, so that's always a plus, you know?
Are you feeling better now?
How about you?
Are you feeling better?
Yeah. No, I'm in fine fettle because I'm talking to you.
Oh, that's nice.
See, that's all I needed, you know? That and the Masked Singer. Now, I have a question about the Masked Singer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do they have, like, aliens on there or anything?
I'm not sure really how to explain the show, Rod. It is... It is really, truly one of the most ridiculous and stupid things I've ever seen. But yet, I'm hypnotically attracted to it.
It's kind of like car wrecks. You know, I saw a preview of it, and I thought, not to be off color, but this looks like an alt furry convention or something.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Except the activities are different. They're a little more tasteful. So that thought looked kind of compelling. But no, I haven't watched it yet. So I'm interested to hear your review.
I'll tell you, Rod. It's a TV show.
So that's kind of like when you submit a script to a movie company, they say, it was interesting.
Yeah.
I'm in trouble now.
Yeah, exactly. Rod, as usual, give everybody the Rod Pyle story, how you got to where you are now and all that cool stuff.
Oh, where I am now. Well, you know, it's not easy to go from a six-figure income to a five-figure one, but if you want to do it quickly, become a book author. Because that's a fast track to success. So, I grew up during the Apollo era, which was a wonderful time to be alive because you were seeing these incredible missions take off as quickly as every couple of months and doing the kind of exploration we've been talking about ever since. And you can watch it on TV. So it was just the coolest thing. And that interest stayed with me. And although I went into TV advertising after college, I finally got into the documentary world and did a little bit of visual effects work on Star Trek and some other things. Then started writing books in about 2004, 2005, and I think last count, if I include the NASA ones, I'm up to 16 or 17. So it's just the best, other than radio, it's probably the best way to make a living there is. It's just a blast.
Right. And we have you on usually about once a month, Rod, and it's always a lot of fun to have you on, man. Lots of stuff to get to, but let's talk about your new book. It's available in a couple of weeks. It's called Interplanetary Robots. Tell everybody about this.
And I just started getting reviews from it, and I'm always a little weirded out for a couple of weeks in between finishing it and, you know, when the reviews start coming in because they set out early copies, and I think, oh, God, what if they suck? What am I going to do? And the truth is, you know, there's always going to be a clinker in there somewhere. It only happens about every third or fourth book for me, but by and large, I've been very enthusiastic, and they say it's an offbeat, engaging, somewhat quirky look at the unmanned space program and so forth. So this is a book about some of JPL's greatest hits, along with the work that the Soviet Union did in the 60s. It's primarily focused on the late 50s up through the end of the 90s, and then up through the end of the Cassini mission, which was just a couple years ago. And, you know, it's trying to take a look at it. It's kind of like their greatest hour. You know, let's look at some of the really exciting, cool missions they did, and then let's look about a third of the chapters are about missions that didn't fly. So, for instance, back in the early 60s, they were planning a Mars lander before we even really knew anything about the planet. I mean, Mariner 4 didn't figure out that the atmosphere was almost non-existent and the dynamics of the planet until 1965. But they were planning this well before that. And by the time they decided not to fly it, it was going to require a Saturn V to launch the thing because it had gotten so huge and heavy. But it had, you know, huge life science lab. It's like flying your high school-sized laboratory to Mars so that you could look for critters. We just didn't know enough about it, so it's probably good that it died an ignominious death. But some of the stories are fascinating. It shows you a lot about how scientists thought then, how that's evolved since then, how government works, how government within NASA works, which is a whole different story.
Yeah.
And then really just looking at how NASA and the Soviet Union, you know, there was this second space race. There was the one to land humans on the moon, which was the big loud one. But there was this second space race to do space spectaculars with robots. And the Russians, again, in that one, were kind of ahead of us for a while. Bigger rockets, bigger machines, really trying to do amazing things. They've had rotten luck at Mars ever since. They still haven't had a complete success there. But they landed a number of big, heavy machines on Venus that actually survived for a couple of hours, which is not easy when it's 900 degrees and 1,000 PSI outside. And one of the things, one of my favorite little bits in the book, if I may, is the Russians, you know, we didn't know anything about Venus. It was completely covered with clouds. We hadn't had radar mappers up there yet.
Yeah.
And here they are saying, well, we're going to land to figure it out, but what if it lands in some kind of an ocean of something? Which, of course, we now know that there can't be. So they had one of their early probes is this kind of acorn-looking thing that would land and open up with these four petals and then sit there and roast while it tried to do the basic science it could for as long as it lasted. And they thought, how do we open this door if it contacts liquid? Now, if it was NASA, they would have figured out sensors and electronic and mechanical ways to open the door and all that. The Russians simply passed the drill inside, closed the door, and then painted sugar water on it. When the sugar water dried, it was meant to hold it closed. And if it got wet, it would pop open. So you got to really love their practicality.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
That is so rudimentary.
That is nuts. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Tell me about the reason. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
That's a little bit how SpaceX works. I mean, it's a whole different example. But, you know, SpaceX is very pragmatic in their approach to things. And we've talked before about going to the factory. Everything's just enough to do it right. It's not over the top. Most of it's not a clean room. It looks like a GM plant, and there's guys with grinders and drills and dragging parts around and so forth. So, I mean, they do an incredible job, and it all works, but it's not engineered to the nth degree. It's enough to do the job right, and that's what's so exciting about what they're doing.
Yeah. Wow. Tell me about the research that you did for interplanetary robots. How long did it take you to write the book? Because it sounds all-encompassing.
It's about a year. You know, the thing is, I've written so many of these that I can often go back, and I've got the notes sitting around already. But, I mean, I'm so blessed that I didn't have to write books back in the bad old days of the library. I love libraries, but you pull out that 3-foot-long drawer with file cards in it and flip through them and hope to God that the book you found was actually on the shelf and wasn't lost or misfiled or something.
Yeah.
And it took forever, and now you get on the Internet, and once you learn where to go, these files are all over the place, and you have to be careful to pick the right ones, the real thing, because, you know, back then in the 60s and 70s, they were just moving along at Warp 9, getting projects done, and they weren't worried about preserving history for people like me 50, 60 years later. So there's a lot of stuff that go to primary references, and they disagree, and things have been edited, and especially if you're looking for, like, voice transcripts from the lunar missions, the Gemini missions, when things are going wrong. You know, those guys would occasionally use a little bit of blue language, but the nice ladies who were typing up the transcripts would sort of rephrase things because they didn't want to use icky words,
right,
you know?
Right.
And then if you go up to JPL and some of the other NASA centers, you can go through their archives. So there's a lot of stuff available. It does take a long time, but again, what's better, you know?
Yeah.
It's a great time to be able to hang out and talk to those people and look up all that stuff. It's wonderful.
The subject for the book, Interplanetary Robots, that you just discussed, that you detailed, when did you come up with the idea that you wanted to specifically write a book about that?
Well, I had written Amazing Stories of the Space Age, which is kind of the human spaceflight version of that. So it was all the wacky missions we thought about, like, oh, let's go build a military base on the moon in 1959 and let's send an modified Apollo spacecraft around Venus in the late 60s, early 70s, and so forth. Things we didn't do and some that we did. And I thought, you know, I want to do a sequel of this for the robotic program because it's also very cool. And it's much less heralded, of course, than the Apollo and Skylab and shuttle programs. So it was originally going to be called, I think, Amazing Stories of the Planets. And that went back and forth with the publisher. And they said, you know, our distributor doesn't think that that's going to gain traction. It sounds too juvenile or something. And I said, well, yeah, maybe. And I kind of liked it because it was juvenile, because that's me. So I said, okay, let's go with your title. So they picked the title. And then I also have another book with that same publisher, Prometheus, coming out at the end of the year called Heroes of the Space Age. That's pretty straightforward. You know, I picked 7 or 8 of my favorite people and wrote them up. And had to apologize in the forward in advance because I know there's going to be people saying, why didn't you do this person? Why didn't you do that person?
Sure.
But I picked the ones I thought really made a difference and left it open-ended, so maybe I'll get a sequel.
Well, there you go.
That.
There you go. All right, so Interplanetary Robots, True Story of the Space Exploration is available on January 29th, and it can be pre-ordered right now for people who are interested.
Right out.
Yeah. And it's at Pyle Books. You can check out pylebooks.com. And then now you have another book that's coming out in February called Space 2.0. And we're going to get to that one a little bit later on because it seems to me like you write a book every 14 minutes.
You know, this is a weird year because I actually have seven on the shelf, but three of them are reprints. And one's a reprint of a book I wrote in 2005 that I didn't even know they were reprinting until somebody said, hey, your old book's out again. I said, huh? So that's just how it works these days, right. You know?
Okay.
They show up everywhere.
There you go. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us again. He is an award-winning filmmaker, writer, journalist on the topic of space, and we're talking all things space. If you have a question or a comment in that regard, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Again, his book, his latest book, is Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of the Space Exploration. It's available in a couple of weeks. Go to pylebooks.com for more information. We got the news coming up next, and then after the news, we're gonna start off with a recap of the major space events of 2018. Always in January, the beginning of each year, we always look back at the other year. We did movies, we did TV, we did news stories, entertainment, stuff like that. And of course, we want to talk about the space events. So, Rod's gonna tell us a recap of some of the major space events that took place in 2018. And again, we'll take your phone calls and questions if you have any, or texts at 312-981-7200. The news is coming up right after this. All right. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. Our 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Also, it's Triple Play Thursday, so get your requests in for that. And we're going to be talking a little bit later about the most popular condiment in each state. We're also going to talk about 30 old useful slang names and for parts of the body, because we love to talk about that kind of stuff. And some amazing Ivy League classes that you can take online for free. And maybe some unusual classes that have been offered or that you've taken in the past. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk or text. And for any of your space-related questions, because my guest right now is Rod Pyle, award-winning filmmaker, writer, and journalist on the topic of space. His latest book is called Interplanetary Robots. It'll be released in a couple of weeks. It's available for pre-order now. And we'd love to have Rod on to talk about all things space. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
All right. So let's do this. The recap of the major space events for 2018 in terms of how was the year 2018 in the world of space and space-related stories?
It was a good one. So I had to pick what I thought were the top ones, because otherwise we'd be here all night, which would be fine with me, but your audience might get bored. I feel like I should have a little bell for each one, you know, ding, February. So I'll just go right into it. So February, we had the launch of the Falcon Heavy, which was, by my estimation, and you could argue this, but I think that's really the beginning of this new space age we've been talking about. I've been talking to groups of kids and young people for years about, you know, the new space age is coming. You just hold on, you know, go to school, study hard. You'll be able to work in it. There'd be jobs everywhere. And now I can say it's here. It's only launched once, but Elon Musk sets up SpaceX, says, I'm going to fly rockets. The traditional industry and NASA go, that's nice, kid. You know, let us know when your rocket blows up.
Right.
They did it, you know, and he's done it many, many times, and now he's become, depending on the year and the month you look at, the preeminent launcher in the Western Hemisphere, very successful. So he says, okay, I'm going to build a big one. So he takes three of his Falcon 9s, straps them together, and figures that that's going to be three times the thrust, much bigger rocket. Turned out to be a little harder than he thought. It took 5 years longer than he planned. But on February 6th, he launched that thing, and on its first test flight, it went off right on time, which never happens, and it flew perfectly, which rarely happens. And there's a lot of experimental technology on there. One small thing is normally when you fly rockets in multiple pieces, you get rid of the parts that you don't need anymore with little explosives. And he said, nah, I don't like explosives. I want to reuse my rockets. So use these little gas pistons to push them off. And as you saw, everything flew back except for the center core, just like it was supposed to. Two side rockets landed themselves. The center one splashed in the ocean, but it worked like it was supposed to up to that point. And he famously launched his red Tesla Roadster into orbit, which some people actually gave him some flack about that. But I thought, you know, and he said it himself, you need to have something heavy up top to simulate payload, right?
Yeah.
So it's either going to be a block of concrete, a block of steel, a bunch of water, or his car. So the images of that car floating around the world with a mannequin sitting in the driver's seat with his left arm draped over the top of the door electrified the world. So I think that was definitely the high point of February.
I got to say, that's one of my favorite videos of last year. That image alone was just fantastic. And also, you know, he made the, you know, like what could be, you know, and he talks about this like, oh, some of these things can be boring, and he wanted to spice it up, and it got people who aren't necessarily interested, you know, in the space exploration or the launching of rockets or anything like that. Suddenly they were like, oh, that's pretty cool. And so I think maybe more people got interested.
I think you're absolutely right, and this is something that he's brilliant at, and it's way better than watching him smoke doobies on TV. So I think that was a brilliant move on his part. More rockets, less pot. You know, that'll be good for him. In April, we had the Hubble Space Telescope, which is the gift that keeps giving, spotted the furthest visible star ever at 9 billion light years, which is only a few billion years after the beginning of the universe. So we're looking way back at the beginning. That's how long it takes the light to reach us. Supernovas we've seen before because they're huge. You know, they're exploding stars. But this is just a regular star doing its business, burning itself up slowly. And the way they did it is what's kind of amazing. Now, Hubble's amazing anyway. You know, it's given us this incredible panoply of images for decades now that have really galvanized people and gotten tons of young people involved in astrophysics and science and so forth. But this one, rather than looking at it directly with the lenses and the mirror in the telescope, they actually use what's called gravitational lensing. So they look for a star that's beyond a star cluster or a distant galaxy. And if they line things up right, and the math involved in this, it doesn't just make my head hurt. It makes me feel like my Labrador, you know, like that IQ separation between me and the guys who do this.
Right.
They line it up so that the light from that star on the far side of that massive object in space is bent around that massive object, which acts as what they call a gravitational lens and magnifies it in this huge scale. And then we look at that magnification of that image. So it's not just a telescope, it's the Uber telescope that's actually using other distant objects, huge objects, to magnify single stars. So that was a big deal. It is worth noting that the Hubble got sidelined this week because they had a camera electronics failure.
Yeah.
Bad moment, but NASA thinks that their backup circuitry will flip into place and be okay, but they can't do it until after the shutdown's over. So come on, let's get on with it.
Yeah.
Figure out your wall. Do whatever you're going to do. Let us get back to business.
Exactly. Yeah, so exactly. I think a lot of people feel that way, Rod.
Yeah, for various reasons. That's just my particular bias. In June, Japan's Hayabusa 2 probe, Hayabusa 1 went and looked at an asteroid years ago. Hayabusa 2 reached asteroid Ryugu and has been sending a series of small landers and crawlers down to its surface. And this is hard to do because these things have very little gravity. So you have to land really slowly or you're going to bounce off and just pivot back into space and be gone.
Yeah.
So they managed to get two of them down there, and they have a third that's going to go in to do some sampling work and actually bring samples back to Earth in 2020. But they discovered that there wasn't as much loose junk sitting around the surface as they had wanted. So they're having to really examine the thing carefully to find something good to sample. When they do go down, they're going to take two samples with one. They're going to whack the surface with a weight and then pick up whatever comes flying off of there. And then for the other one, which is the deep surface sampler, they're going to fire this heavy bullet into it. It's not tungsten. It's some other rare earth element that I can't remember, but it's incredibly dense. And basically, a little gun will fly off from the spacecraft, fire a bullet into the side of Ryugu, and then whatever comes out of the surface mat, they'll pick up the chips and the powder and bring that home.
Wow.
And we've done this once before with a cometary sample, but this will really be a good-looking asteroid. And people, you know, wonder, well, they're just rocks out in space. What's the big deal? what we're looking for, and this is also what OSIRIS-REx, which is another NASA probe, which is currently orbiting an asteroid called Bennu, is looking for. We want to know more about what they're made of and how they're put together for two reasons. One, there's a lot of resources up there, so we can get metal off of them to build spacecraft parts and so forth ultimately. And there's water there, so we think we can get water, make rocket fuel, and make air, and make drinking water with the ice and so forth. So this means this is all stuff we don't have to launch from Earth. It's just hang around space. Let's go up, live off the land. Everything's cheaper and moves faster. And finally, we need to learn how to protect our planet from these things, because eventually one's going to be heading right for us, and we need to know how to divert it. So the more you learn about them, the safer it will be.
Right. That
makes sense. So that's June.
Yep. Okay.
July, JPL and the European Space Agency announced that they had spotted a huge lake of liquid water beneath the surface of Mars. So we knew there was a lot of water ice there, but we hadn't definitively found any bodies of liquid water. So this isn't on the surface. This is down below, quite a ways down. But it's about 12 miles across, probably briny, but where there's liquid water in any form, there could be life. And it also lets us know that if we're willing to drill or melt ice, there's plenty of water up there to do the same thing I was talking about with the asteroid. So it's important to know, you know, we're not going to have fields of poppies and coffee there to be able to draw from, but there's ice there and other resources. So that was kind of big news.
Yeah.
September was Saturn news. The Opportunity rover, which has been operating since 2004, finally gave up the ghost. There was a global dust storm that went on for months, and Opportunity is Curiosity rover has a nuclear power supply in it. Opportunity has solar panels, and it was so dark for so long that the batteries ran down. They hoped it would reboot itself when the sunlight came back, but it hasn't appeared to. So in about another week, I think, they're going to send up their last couple of pings and see if they can get it to wake up. And if it doesn't, then we say bye-bye for good. But it traveled 30 miles and explored a lot of the surface and really was the first rover to extensively chart the history of water on the planet. So we're still looking at that. But that was really the one that told us what the water cycle was. Do I have time to keep going?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. October, we had a weird thing. We were launching a couple of astronauts up the space station on the Russian Soyuz, the MS-10 mission. And we've been doing that for years. That's what replaced the shuttle. This one had a problem. And when it was staging, the first stage of stage rockets are separating the second stage, there was a problem. And the rocket did what it was supposed to do. It detected the problem and said, oops, I'm in danger. I'm firing the escape rockets. And so the rocket on top of the capsule separated the capsule from the top of the booster and took these guys for a wild ride for a few miles up and then let them parachute back. Very violent. If you saw the video, their arms are flapping, their heads are going all over the place.
Yeah.
But that's how you save astronauts, you know? So it got them away from it and brought them back, and everything was fine. There was some concern about how long that program would have to lay down and figure out the problems. There's been some quality control issues with the Russian space program, but everything appears to be fine, and we're back on schedule. November, the InSight lander landed on Mars.
Before you jump into November, I also want to mention the whole hole being drilled into the space station, which was such a weird story, and inspired one of the most brilliant bits that John Oliver did on his show all year long, where he had the lineup of the mice that may have actually drilled the hole. That was one of my favorite. Right. That was one of my favorite space related stories of the year too.
Well, and thankfully it was in. There's two pieces to these Soviet spaceships. There's the capsule and the orbital module. So it was in the orbital module, which is kicked loose while they're reentering. So it wasn't critical. But still, you know, what a moment.
Yeah.
You're thinking, well, NASA told us there's a leak in the station. Where is it? Oh, it's over. Wait a minute. There's a hole here. Was it a meteorite? No, there's a bunch of drill marks next to it, and it was from the inside, as near as they could tell. So the Russians had all kinds of conspiracy theories they spun, and they said, oh, an American astronaut did it because they were suicidal and wanted to come home early.
Right.
As near as anybody could tell, it was a manufacturing defect or something deliberately done on Earth. They tried to patch it. The patch popped off, and it leaked.
There
so hopefully
right.
that won't happen again.
Oh, we hope so.
Afternoon.
Oh, yeah. Rod, hang on. We'll jump back into November when we come back, okay?
You bet.
All right. Rod Pyle is with us. He is an award-winning filmmaker, writer, journalist on the topic of space, and he's running down a recap of all the major space events that happened last year. And we'll find out more about that right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Good morning. It's Thursday. Triple Play Thursday coming up. Yeah! That's one artist, three songs. Get your request in now. We'll play them later. That's 312-981-7200. That's also the number for talk or text. Any of your space-related questions. Rod Pyle is with us, and we're talking space stories. And if you guys have a question or a comment, it's 312-981-7200. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, Rod Pyle is with us, award-winning filmmaker, writer, journalist on the topic of space. He's got a brand-new book coming out at the end of the month called Interplanetary Robots, and he has been running down the big major space events that took place last year, and we're up to the month of November, and let's welcome Rod. Rod, right back. Welcome back.
Thank you. So November, we had the Mars InSight lander, which was a little harder to sell than the rovers because to a lot of people it's less exciting because it just sits there. You know, it's a static lander.
Right.
But this was a unique mission because it was doing something, I think we talked about this about the time it was landing, and doing something it hadn't done before, which is really studying the interior of the planet. So we know the surface. We've seen how the surface is laid out. We kind of get an idea of where the water went and where we might be able to find life if any ever existed. But we didn't really understand the interior dynamics as well as we'd like, even though they had done a lot of work with, you know, trying to chart the gravity lumps and how the core might be working and so forth. So the InSight lander set down on November 26th, and it has two main instruments and kind of a third experiment. So the two main instruments are a seismometer and a heat flow probe. So the seismometer obviously is looking for Mars quakes. They had one of those on the Vikings. One didn't work at all, and the other one didn't work very well because they discovered having it mounted up on the deck of the lander when the wind blew, the lander shook, and the seismometer went, oh, my God, I'm having an earthquake. So that didn't work. So this one they built separate. It looks like a big chafing dish almost. So when it landed, a couple of clamps released, and a robotic arm grabs this thing and has set it down on the surface. They found a nice smooth spot to put it. So that'll start sending back data pretty soon. The heat flow experiment is a really interesting thing because it's another box that you have to set down the surface. Mm. And it's got this coiled up snake, or the I think they call it a mole in it, which is like a coiled thick rope. And as it uncoils, it's got a hammer inside of it down at the front tip, and it bangs against itself and actually tunnels down into the dirt. So the hope is that'll go down about 16 feet, and then they can measure how heat flows out of the planet from the interior upwards. And again, you know, really smart guys, by looking at 16 feet, they can extrapolate what's going on all the way down to the core, and they'll figure out how big the core is, how active it still is, how warm it might be, and all these questions we've had for a long time. And I asked Jim Green, who's the chief scientist for NASA now, and I saw him at JPL for the landing. I said, what's the big deal about Mars quakes? I mean, why do we care so much? And he said, well, it's good science, but think about it. We're going to have to build habitats. We send people there. We have to know how hard the ground is going to shake before these things cave in. And I said, that's a really good point.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to look for that, and then it's also going to study. They've seen that there's been a number of polar reversals on Mars like we have had on Earth over history. And we may have one coming up in the not-too-distant future here, so we want to learn more about what happens when North flips to south, and the protection from solar radiation goes away for a while. So that'd be good to know.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
So that's a big deal, and so that everything's going swimmingly with that. Also that month, the Kepler Space Telescope, which has discovered over 2,000 exoplanets, finally gave up the ghost. Ran out of fuel. The gyroscopes had been malfunctioning and so forth. So they knew its days were limited. So they used it right up to the final moments. Got down the last big batch of data. We're getting ready to try and fire it up one last time, and it just wasn't having it. So that's been replaced by another space telescope called TESS, which looks for exoplanets a whole different way. And TESS, rather than just looking at one chunk of sky for months at a time, which is how Kepler worked, TESS will eventually chart the entire celestial sphere. So it's going to look in every direction. It's looking for closer exoplanets. And we'll get a much better idea of what we're surrounded by. So that's very cool. Finally, in that month, Voyager 2, which was launched in 1977, but we're still talking to it, finally left the solar system. We had been waiting for years. Voyager 1 exited, I think, in 2013. And part of what's interesting about this is not just what's on the other side of that boundary. So the boundary of the solar system, of the effects of the sun, are where the solar wind kind of gives out and gives up to the pressure of the radiation and the particles that are coming in from outside, from the rest of the galaxy, yeah, and from outside of space.
Yeah.
So crossing that boundary twice now has been very interesting, because it turns out it's not just a place, but it's this entire region that's lumpy and folded. And all, it looks like, almost, if you charted it, it would look like a brain, all these weird folds and stuff. So we're discovering all kinds of stuff about that that they didn't know. So that was a big deal. Finally, in December, we have OSIRIS-REx reaching Bennu. That's that other asteroid explorer.
Mm.
And China's newest lunar lander, Chang'e 4, which we're probably going to talk about in a little bit,
yeah,
reached lunar orbit. We'll talk about that landing later. And Virgin Galactic, our favorite rocket plane,
yeah,
finally got to the edge of space. It wasn't space as defined by the scientists, but it's space as defined by NASA and the Air Force, saying, okay, it's 50 miles up, that's good enough. And they've been talking about this, that since 2007. So it looks like, with everything working as well as it has been, they might actually start flying passengers this year. So that's really cool. The very last thing is, and this was right at the edge of the year, so in our time, it was 9:30 on New Year's Eve. At East Coast time, it was 12:30 in the morning. The New Horizons probe flew past Ultima Thule, which is the furthest thing we've ever seen in space, period. And within a couple of days, it sent back some images of that very weird distant body. So that's our year in space.
And is there anything that you're predicting that might happen in 2019? Anything interesting that you could see on the horizon?
Oh, man, this is going to be a huge year. So we've got the second and possibly third flights of the Falcon Heavy, and they'll be carrying cargo up this time, not for the space station, but missions. I think the first one's the Air Force. I don't remember what the second one's for, but just seeing that thing fly will be remarkable. We'll also have the first test flights, both unmanned and probably with crews in them, of both the Falcon 9 with its Dragon 2 capsule, sending a crew to the space station ultimately, and also Boeing Starliner, which is their competition. They're kind of racing to see, they're within a couple of months of each other at this point, so we're all kind of placing our bets to see who's gonna get up there first.
Mm.
So that's going to be a big thing. We're ramping up for the Mars 2020 rover, which is going to be renamed pretty soon. They're going to have another contest with school kids.
There you go.
So that'll be launching in the next year. And, yeah, all kinds of stuff, especially the private sector, is going to be happening. So that's really heating up, and that's exciting as hell.
All right. That's awesome. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is going to hang out with us after the news, because we didn't even really get to the new stories that we wanted to talk about. And there's more of that coming up. We're going to talk more space. And again, his latest book is called Interplanetary Robots. It comes out in 2 weeks. And we'll talk more about that and his other book, which is coming out. He's got another book coming out as well. So Rod's going to hang with us after the news, and that's what's coming up next. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How's everybody doing this morning? It's Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday coming up. Yeah! That means one artist, three songs. You pick the bumps to the theme every morning, and we'll get to that in a little bit. 312-981-7200. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on the 18th floor above Chicago, and we're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6, and I will actually be hanging out with Steve Cochran and the gang for my weekly Thursday visit at 6:20, and we'll talk about my favorite and least favorite movies of 2018 this morning. And if you were listening Monday morning, you heard Colin and Eric and I reveal our favorite films and least favorite films of 2018. And if you haven't, if you didn't tune in, that podcast is available at WGNRadio.com if you want to hear our favorite movies of the year and that that discussion. It was a lot of fun. So that's what's coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going to talk about the most popular condiments in each state. We're going to talk about some slang names for body parts and some unbelievable Ivy League classes that you can take online for free, and some unusual classes that have been offered in the past, and ones maybe that you have taken. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. And again, if you have any questions or comments about space, our good friend Rod Pyle is with us. He's hanging out again here. He's an award-winning filmmaker, writer, journalist on the topic of space, and he is the senior publisher of Ad Astra, which is a publication of the National Space Society, and his latest book is called Interplanetary Robots, available in a couple of weeks, and you can pre-order it now. His website is pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. And he just ran down all the major events space-related from 2018. Now we got some new stories to talk about, and Rod, welcome back, sir. Thanks for hanging out.
Thanks. I love to. And now I'm going to have to stay up all night so I can find out what your least favorite movies of the year were. You got me hooked, man.
Well, I can tell you this, Rod. On my best of list, First Man is on it. So that was one of my favorite movies of last year.
How many times did you see it? Just once?
Twice.
Twice. Okay. I'm still, you know, I was waiting for it to come on cable, streaming, so I could watch it again. I just saw it once, and I think we talked about this, but, you know, I really liked it while I was there, and then the further away I got from it, the more kind of rankled I got. I thought, wait a minute, hold on, hey, you know, there's just stuff that bugged me about it, but it was really involving, and I think, you know, it's one version of the Armstrong myth, but it's a good one, and it's really a story well told. Man, Gosling, you know, Armstrong wasn't quite that strung out emotionally, but Gosling did a hell of a job.
Yeah, I agree. And I saw it in IMAX, which was the way to see it, because it was amazing.
Yeah.
And the second time I saw it, I have to say it was on my TV screen. I had a screener of it, and it was a little bit of a different experience than seeing it in IMAX, which was really kind of overwhelming at times.
Yeah, and so for the second time, did you come away kind of thinking, geez, I wouldn't want to meet Buzz Aldrin? I mean, I thought their portrayal was really unfair.
That was the thing. We talked a little bit about that, because at the first time I saw it, I was like, wow, man, he really comes off as kind of a jerk in this. And by the way, speaking of Buzz Aldrin, he wrote the foreword for your book, Space 2.0.
Yeah, and also for the Apollo book that's coming out a couple months later. So, yeah, Buzz and I had a good year together. And, I mean, you know, just because I know him doesn't mean I say nice things about him.
Yeah.
He is different than the other guys, and he didn't really fit into that crowd in terms of socializing and so forth.
Right.
As well as most of them did. But, you know, he's not that guy. He's just not that guy. Yeah. So, yeah, I think they need to give him a little bit of a break. So let's give him a boost in the shoulder. So, good man. One of the first two guys in the moon. And that's where we'll leave it.
Exactly. Okay. All right. Let's get to some of these some of the stories that we wanted to get to. Now, we had mentioned the Chang'e probe, Chang'e 4 probe, a little bit earlier on. But there's some news about that, the landing.
So they went into orbit around the moon on December 12th, and they did a very smart thing, which is what we did early on, particularly with the Viking missions to Mars, went into orbit and spent some time looking for the right place to set down. They knew pretty much where they wanted to go, but this way they could map it, really look, make a final decision. And then on January 2nd, China time, they set down. And this, what makes this mission remarkable, you know, up till now, China's kind of been letting those of us in the West who are watching relive the space race. You know, they set up their first crewed capsule in the early 2000s. Then they set up a couple of small space stations. Nothing like Skylab, but they didn't need to be. You know, they just wanted to prove out the technology. They're going to set up a much larger modular station in the early 2020s. On the unmanned side, they've been doing all this work at the moon. Had a rover that went about 300 feet before it stalled. Lander, they'd done some orbiters. And now this one is finally doing something really new and different that the U.S. and the Soviet Union both looked at, but just decided it was a little more challenging than they wanted to take on in the 60s and 70s, and that is landing on the far side. Now, the far side is often called the dark side. It's not dark. It goes through the same phases as the far side that faces us.
Right.
Otherwise, we wouldn't see half or a crescent moon. But because one side of the moon is always facing the Earth, it's considered tidally locked is what they call it, it's very hard to see the backside unless you're in orbit. So this is the first time anything that could send back images landed on the far side of the moon, and it's a lander and a rover. And so far it's landed, the rover's driven off, it's headed towards a crater just ahead of where it landed, and now it's shut down for the lunar night, and then a couple of weeks it'll come back into business. What's really remarkable, besides being on the far side, is that it set down in this region called the South Polar Aiken Basin, which is a huge impact crater. I think the biggest one on the moon, very ancient impact. And the nice thing is Mother Nature's done this big favor for us, which has churned up the surface down to this old bedrock. So they'll be able to get some geological samples that go way back into lunar history. So that's exciting. The other thing that's exciting about this, besides just the fact that they managed to launch a rover with to land a rover with this fairly new program, is that when you're on the far side of the moon, you don't have any radio contact with Earth because you got this big rock in between you and all the radios down in China.
Yeah.
So So they had to orbit a satellite ahead of time that's in this kind of permanent spot off to the side where it stays in more or less one place. So it's relaying all the data back and forth. So it's actually going from the rover to that satellite back to Earth and vice versa. So it's just a really exciting thing. They're looking for the history of the moon, looking for a lot of geological science. Hopefully there might be some what they call cold traps, so there might be a little bit of ice or something, because we think there's a lot of water ice on the moon. So the sooner we find out, the sooner we can start setting up colonies there. And in the immediate future, they're planning to build up a larger scale robotic base with multiple missions, and then probably by the end of the 2020s, maybe earlier, start sending astronauts of their own up there to land and kind of repeat what we did and then move off into new territory.
Mm. Wow, that's great. That's really great. Now, is there any kind of competition do other countries or if they accomplish something, do the Americans get jealous? Does that still happen?
Well, you wouldn't think so by talking to NASA, because it's like, you know, we applaud their achievement. We're all in the same game, one for all and all for one and all that.
Right.
But yeah, there's plenty of people in various levels of government and even private industry, I think, that are saying, you know, we did this 50 years ago. What are we waiting for? Let's go back. Obama famously said, been there, done that, which is really unfair because, as Neil Armstrong pointed out, we've only explored about as much of the moon as a small town, and there's a whole lot more of it than that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's the beginnings of another space race there. Buzz Aldrin famously has said, you know, let's cooperate with these guys. Think of what we could do together. The Chinese, maybe the Russians, the Indians are going to be putting people into orbit in a couple of years. Let's bring this together. But we got a lot of federal laws in place that say that we can't cooperate on this kind of technological venture with the Chinese because of concerns about technology transfer and defense and
sure,
so forth.
Sure.
So for now it's blocked, but hopefully in the near future we can work this out and do some incredible things.
Okay. All right. The New Horizon probe, news on that, correct?
Yeah. So that flew past Ultima Thule, which is this object that's out in what's called the Kuiper Belt, which is, I'm not sure I pronounced that exactly right. We go back and forth about this, but Kuiper Belt. And it's this big band of junk in the outer solar system beyond the orbit of Neptune, possibly where Pluto came from, since it appears to be a captured object, not native to that part of the solar system. And it's just all the unfinished crud that didn't make it into planets. So it's kind of like if Pluto's the trailer park, then all the stuff in the Kuiper Belt is the car parts out in the back 40, you know, it's just ice and rock kind of drifting around out there. So this is a billion miles past Pluto. It's 4 billion miles out there. And they managed to fly within 2,200 miles of this thing with a spacecraft that is 4 billion miles out and has a round trip radio time of 12 hours, 6 hours out and 6 hours back.
Wow.
So as you can imagine, it was doing some thinking on its own. And it photographed this object and sent the stuff back really fast. And it looks, they say it looks like an orange snowman. I think it looks like a diseased bowling pin. I mean, it's just really weird. They call it a contact binary. So it's apparently two chunks of rocky ice that came together at a very low speed enough that instead of bouncing off each other or destroying each other, they just got stuck. So it's these two balls, one bigger than the other. It's about 20, 30 miles across, the widest. And so they're just beginning to really figure out, okay, what are the dynamics of this thing? And this is just a flyby. It's not an orbiter. So it's headed off to hopefully another target in a couple of years. But what I found kind of stunning is the data is coming back. So they gathered probably 5-6 gigabytes of data as they go by, very compressed. You know, they're masters of compression. And it's coming back at 2 kilobytes per second. And if you remember the AOL and CompuServe days,
yeah.
It's about that range. It's going to take 2 years to send back the data they collected from this thing. So it's really an incredible achievement, and is able to image objects as small as about 100 feet across. And so we're going to get a much better look at that thing as the data comes back and figure out what's going on way out there in the big dark.
You know, you bring this, so we brought this up before, Rod, and we talk about some of the things that have been launched out, and the technology that's on board these things is way behind where we're at now on Earth. And there is that difference between that, and that adds a barrier as well, right?
It shocking. You know, when you look at the microprocessors on these things, it's called a MIPS R3000 processor, which was first designed, the early version of it, before 1990. Huh. It operates at 12 megahertz. But, you know, you need microprocessors that the military's had time to work with private industry to harden, in their case, against nuclear attack, in this case, against all the nasty radiation in the outer solar system. So it's a really slow, dumb processor, but their software is so efficient, you're not running Windows 10 on this thing because it wouldn't even wake up.
Yeah,
it's able to do incredible things. And it's essentially acting as an AI probe out there on these ancient processors. It's the same with the Mars spacecraft. So it's just the amount of engineering they do with the software alone is pretty stunning.
Yeah. All right. Okay, and then finally, Musk mania.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been quiet for a while. We had the Falcon Heavy. He's been doing routine launches with the Falcon 9 since then. That's great. We were still waiting for the BFR, the Big Falcon Rocket, or Big Effing Rocket, depending on which definition
right,
you believe.
Right.
Now renamed the Starship. So it has a new fancy name.
Right.
And so to perfect, because this also is going to be reusable, so it'll go up like a big rocket and come back and land kind of like the Falcon 9 does, but they got to test it. So when they're getting ready to fly the Falcon 9 in its reusable flights, they had a thing called Grasshopper that was a much smaller version of it that tested the lifting off and the landing and the lifting off the landing and maneuvering and so forth. So they're getting ready to start doing hop tests with this mini Starship. And only 6 weeks ago, the area where they're testing it was empty, and now they got a rocket mostly built out there. So they've been putting this thing together out there. It's got three of their big new engines on it, which are much larger than the Falcon 9 engines. They're called Raptors, and they're about 450,000 pounds of thrust, so roughly a third of what each Saturn V engine had. 30 feet in diameter, 130 feet tall. It's going to go up to as far as 3 miles and flights for as long as 6 minutes. It's pretty much empty inside. It's got lots of sensors and so forth, but it's really about the hull and the engines. It's going to go up, hover, maneuver a bit, land, and then do it again and again, wash, rinse, and repeat until they make sure they got it right. And then it looks like he's on schedule to start doing flights with this thing in a few years. And as you know, not only is that scheduled to fly out by the moon in a couple of years with a bunch of private passengers, but also to be able to get us from L.A. to Shanghai at about 40 minutes reliably at roughly the same price he claimed in the first-class ticket. So this is that big first step.
Wow.
Tony Stark.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Elon Musk. Okay. Well, listen, yeah. Rod, always a pleasure to talk to you. Your next book is called Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration, and it's available on January 29th. People can pre-order it now. And your other book, Space 2.0, is coming out at the end of February, correct?
Yeah, that's a look at the new space age. Kind of the only book of its kind so far that I've seen. I'm sure there will be others, but I was lucky enough to think of it early. So, yeah, end of February.
And Buzz Aldrin, again, wrote the forward. And Buzz Aldrin...
Yeah, he wrote a great forward.
Buzz Aldrin, by the way, is a nice man, despite what First Man says.
He's really a very decent guy, I have to say.
All right, very cool. Rod, always a pleasure, man. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks, Nick. Have a good evening.
Okay, buddy. Take care. Rod Pyle. He was a great guy, expert on space, always fun to listen to and talk to. A senior publisher of Ad Astra, a publication of the National Space Society. And again, his latest books, Interplanetary Robots, will be available at the end of the month. All right, let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN.